introduce to you our speaker, Reverend Dr. Heidi Swartz, is a community minister whose ministry has included teaching, scholarship on social movements in American politics, and preaching and rites of passage. She is currently in training as a chaplain at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Reverend Swartz has a special expertise in faith institutional-based community organizing. Introduce Reverend Dr. Heidi Schwartz.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you for braving this really nasty weather. This is Martin Luther King Jr. Sunday. And my rather cryptic sermon title is Black and White versus Gray. And by the way, let me apologize for coughing. I seem to have a persistent cough, so excuse me. Very persistent. So black and white versus gray. There's lots of possible meanings of that phrase. And black and white obviously bring to mind these two races that Europeans constructed and these categories that we, through history, everyone, has made real through our social structures, all signified by color of skin, the basis for the movement of which Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the most visible symbol. But black and white, as we know, are used as symbols of absolute opposites. Because as colors, white is the sum of all colors, and black is the absence of all color. And gray, if you look at your paint box, is what happens when you mix black and white together. So naturally, the colors black and white have come to symbolize absolutes, and gray symbolizes when it isn't so simple or clear. The question I want to ask today is about the recent protests against police brutality set off by the killings of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in Staten Island, and the decisions of the two grand juries called to investigate them not to indict the respective police officers. And my question is, can these protests be the basis of a new civil rights movement? You may not be surprised that my answer is not black or white. Now, the American Civil Rights Movement began formally with the Montgomery bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955. And I'm hoping there'll be at least one fact that hopefully every one of you learns for the first time. Make no mistake, there's all kinds of black protests and activism before that bus boycott. And there was even at least one prior attempted bus boycott elsewhere in the South, I believe in Florida. I didn't have time to look that up, but there was an attempted bus boycott. And guess what else? Rosa Parks had refused more than once before to sit in the, or to give up her seat in the white section of the bus. She wasn't just tired that day, as the myth goes. She was a trained political activist, active in her local NAACP chapter, which was dangerous at that time and place, and she was trained at the Integrated Highlander Center, the famous training center for social justice, in social change techniques. So she was trained and active. But my point here is that what became a national social movement of epic proportions began with the goal of one local bus boycott. And not just local, but for only one day. Organizers saw a one-day boycott would be a major achievement. It was organized to a T by a local black coalition One of the member groups was called the Women's Political Caucus. So there's a black women's group. Leader Joanne Robinson helped get the word out to black Montgomery not to get on the bus the next day by making flyers on her college's mimeograph machine. Now, I think everyone here is old enough to know what a mimeograph machine is. Just think of the precursor. Maybe you aren't, but I bet you are. Precursor to of the photocopier. And it was, of course, a historically black college. She could have never gotten away with it anywhere else. One of the advantages of segregation, ironically. By concentrating all the black people in cities and towns where they're near each other, not so much in the countryside, it made people easier to organize, given that there was no Facebook, Twitter, iPhones, or Instagram. So the mighty civil rights movement began as an exercise in community organizing with a one-day goal: keep black people off the buses to show their potential economic clout, not just with the offensive and humiliating bus company, which was particularly a grievance locally, but to Montgomery business as a whole. Boycott organizers were overwhelmed when something like 98 or 99% of Montgomery African Americans stayed off those buses. And so, what do you do with that energy? Well, their vision and their goals grew. And by the way, their Monday night mass meetings at the church, the churches were key to keeping the momentum growing. It was longtime local leader E.D. Nixon, who is one of my great heroes, and other local black leaders, no less worthy of being heroes, who conceived of inviting a new young minister to become the public face of the bus boycott, that is, its image and its leader. E.D. Nixon, who's also is a labor leader, civil rights leader, active for decades in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, who were black, of course. E.D. Nixon was not an educated man. He knew that with his uneducated diction, he would not command the wide respect that an educated and eloquent black minister would. Furthermore, this particular young minister hadn't been in town long enough to become co-opted by the white power establishment, like some of the other black ministers in town. And even more, he was so new, he was kind of like neutral territory. He hadn't had time to make any enemies. So there were so many behind-the-scenes strategic reasons for selecting this new young minister, Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. And this is how he began to forge his historic destiny. Now, as we know, the civil rights movement, in its formal, fully mass-mobilized phase, spanned just a little over a decade, and that's a long time for sustained mass mobilization. It included multiple organizations which had different constituencies and leaders. They included the oldest was the NAACP, but even more importantly, King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that was the minister's group, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, the student group, the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, and many other groups. And these national famous groups had hundreds of local chapters with deep roots. And where they didn't have roots, they were created. And they were built from deep roots. The movement had entire sub-movements that represented different whole strategies or areas of focus. The Freedom Riders, who strove to desegregate transportation. The students, who had lunch counter sit-ins. The arduous efforts at black voter registration. The below-the-radar citizenship schools that SNCC ran. And many other local organizing efforts. The mass meetings and hundreds of marches and demonstrations in the South and throughout the country in solidarity for voting rights, now memorialized in the new film, Selma. So what about today's movement, if we can call it that, against police brutality, against a particularly young African-American man? After all, one of the events that kicked off the civil rights movement, that is, informally in 55, the Montgomery boycott, that laid the way a year or two before, was the lynching of young Emmett Till, who was a 12-year-old boy from Chicago visiting relatives in Mississippi. Keep in mind, he's from the North. He did not understand that being a smartass to a white woman in a local store would cost him his life. What he actually did, and he did this on a dare from some of the local boys who knew that this, you know, what might happen, or that this was forbidden, was he said to this woman, "Bye, baby." This was worthy of the death penalty, though informally. Kind of like selling Lucy's loose cigarettes on Staten Island. Or is it? Here's where you open up a can of worms. To many, today's victims are not as sympathetic as the murdered innocents of the civil rights movement. Emmett Till, the four little girls killed in the Birmingham church bombing, all dressed so perfectly. Unitarian Universalist minister James Reeb, murdered at Selma. And so many, many more, mostly black, mostly not famous. Some would say Eric Garner was no innocent 12-year-old. He was a 43-year-old father of six. He'd been arrested 30 times since 1980 on charges that included assault, resisting arrest, and grand larceny. Furthermore, some would say, well, he made the stupid decision to resist arrest. Although, well, he didn't have a weapon or anything. But it's a little grayer today. But notice the offense for which he was put in that chokehold that appears to have led to his death was possibly selling Lucy's loose, untapped cigarettes. And that's not even to mention that whatever his arrest record, it had nothing to do with this possible offense, much less the excessive force that resulted in that death, a death ruled a homicide. Indeed, the disparity over Mr. Garner's possible offense and the physical violence used against him ignited hundreds of demonstrations, hundreds, including mass mobilizations against police practices in black communities. Now, some would argue that cases like Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, are even less black and white and more gray. He actually robbed a convenience store, although apparently unarmed, and he shoved a store clerk, and his attempted arrest was in direct response to this robbery. Even popular black singer Pharrell Williams criticized Michael Brown's behavior as, quote, bullyish in an interview with Ebony magazine. However, you could also see him as, you know, this, what was it, 18-year-old shoplifter who may have simply mouthed off to the police. What's even more gray are the circumstances of the shooting. But what everyone definitely saw was a militarized police response to the violent and mostly nonviolent protests that went on for days and that heightened the conflict. What ignited the protests is the obvious fact that these two men were killed for minor or no crimes. There have been 14 black teens killed since Michael Brown. And the bottom line is that these two cases, however fuzzy or gray they may seem to some, or not, are just the tip of the iceberg of racism at every level of the criminal justice system, from the streets, to the courts, to the laws, to the jails, to the prisons, to the status of ex-felons. Surely this is a movement for our times. And yet, those who break the law do not make us sympathetic movement figureheads as a Rosa Parks, the squeaky clean heroine of Montgomery. A white woman I know complained about Brown and Garner. How come you aren't even allowed to bring up their arrest records? And if you do, you're vilified. And behind closed doors, or even openly, you know plenty of white people out there are saying, well, if they would have just done what the police told them and not resisted arrest, they wouldn't be dead today. But guess what? Plenty of white people in the 50s and 60s saw African Americans, let us not forget, especially movement leaders, as unruly, frightening renegades. My white sixth grade teacher, I remember well, told stories of being hassled in the ghetto of Pittsburgh, and he told us Martin Luther King was a troublemaker. Plenty of white liberal ministers told King to wait. It's just not time. These are things it's hard for us to believe today. Many people don't even know. These perceptions ensured that movement strategists selected squeaky clean public movement figures. Claudette Colvin, an unwed teenage mother, was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on the bus 9 months before Rosa Parks' famous arrest. But the boycott's local leaders felt Parks made a much better test case for integration. She was an adult. Claudette Colvin was 16. She was respectable. No unwed children floating around. Remember, this is 1955, too. And she looked middle class. She was, I believe she was educated. She was a seamstress. Now, this may seem unfair today, but it was a smart, tactical move at the time. Which brings us to tactics and strategy, the long-term vision and goals, and the tactics designed to get there. I started this sermon with a question. Can the protests against racism and policing be the basis of a new civil rights movement? Are they already? Some would think the answer is either black or white. And this falls not really on racial lines, but on generational lines. One viewpoint, identified with the old fogies, says that many protests do not a movement make. The man who taught me community organizing first is one of these old fogies. Mike Miller was one of the original Freedom Riders. He's a veteran of Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964, and he's spent his life organizing for social change. Here's something Mike wrote recently about the protests in Ferguson, which included, of course, looting and violence, as well as much, much more nonviolence. But it was ununified. Mike writes, and I quote him, "In the 1960 and 1961 civil rights movement, young African Americans engaged in highly disciplined sit-ins and freedom rides. In 1962, some of them organized similarly disciplined voting rights and political activity that shook the country. That civil rights movement ended Jim Crow and public accommodations, voting rights, and the Democratic Party. Bob Moses, who was the head of SNCC, called what the students did an earned insurgency. Their discipline earned the respect of the country. I cannot help but contrast that with what is going on now." And he's referring to the Ferguson protests, I believe. However, just the cause of ending police brutality and harassment, and it is indeed very just, I should have read, however just the cause, it will not reach a majority of Americans in the present way it states its case. And I reject the blanket indictment of cops. There are rotten cops and rotten departments. There are also cops who do what they should, protect persons and property. Unquote. Wow, some radical. But this is the voice of someone who learned that people of all colors want the American dream, that the epidemic of drugs and guns hurts poor neighborhoods, not rich ones, and people want to be safe in their own homes, and He's speaking strategically, not morally. Now, other observers are a bit more positive about the recent activism. In a piece on the great behind-the-scenes organizer Ella Baker, first of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and then later SNCC, longtime organizer and political scientist Peter Dreyer writes the following. We witnessed the rebirth of a new civil rights movement sparked by the police killings of young black men, but rooted in the underlying grievances of racial injustice around jobs, housing, schools, and the criminal justice system. As the protests spread from Ferguson to Los Angeles, New York, Cleveland, and around the country, today's young activists can learn much from Ella Baker's ideas. Working behind the scenes, she helped transform the Southern sit-in protests into a powerful movement for racial justice, led by young people with lots of anger and determination, but little political experience. Note, and I repeat that for emphasis, Dreyer said, led by young people with lots of anger and determination, but little political experience. The civil rights movement was a huge epic with many episodes and campaigns. Perhaps the beginning of the lunch counter sit-ins, conducted largely by young people, students, has something in common with these recent demonstrations that we've observed against police violence. Dreyer notes that in 2 months, just February and March of 1960, such a short time, sit-ins had spread to 55 cities in 13 states. Many students, mostly black but also white, were arrested for trespassing, disorderly conduct, or disturbing the peace. Now, then I doubt they were doing those things, while today some students were, or some participants were. But in just 2 months, sit-ins had spread to 55 cities. I would say the recent protests have certainly equaled in scope those early sit-ins. But back to 1960 again. Over Easter weekend, April 16th to 18th, many of those students came to Ella Baker's alma mater, Shaw University, a black college in Raleigh, North Carolina, to discuss how to capitalize on the growing momentum of the sit-ins. The fruit of the meeting was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, an organization to translate these local actions into a wider movement. SNCC would expand the sit-in campaign, but it also used other tactics, such as the freedom rides and the voter registration drives, to tear down segregation. At that time, the movement was really in need of reinvigoration, and SNCC's work did that job. Earlier, going back, let's go back to Montgomery in 55-56. What was key to turning a local organizing victory, and there was a Supreme Court decision, but it only applied to Montgomery. It said that Montgomery, Alabama's segregated bus system was illegal. What was key to turning that into a national movement? It could have ended right there. Well, it didn't turn into a national movement on its own. Once again, organizers with vision, Ella Baker, Bayard Rustin, and Stanley Levinson, who's heard of him, key advisor to King. They organized Northern Financial Support, although I would add most of the funding for the boycott itself was indigenous, came out of the black churches and collections. These strategists thought and planned how to build a mass movement. Bayard Rustin envisioned, quote, disciplined groups prepared to act as, quote, nonviolent shock troops, end quote. The three strategists talked with King about founding a new organization to build campaigns and take them throughout the South. And this was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which projected King into becoming a national leader. Ella Baker was brought on to run it, to run the organization itself. And then she left when she saw the opportunity to build a more grassroots, mass-based organization out of the lunch counter sit-ins. And that was SNCC. She organized the founding meeting of over 300 young leaders. Peter Dreyer writes, quote, SNCC might have quickly disintegrated had Baker not nurtured it and helped the students learn to run the organization on their own. Some young activists today know that they are like the youth in SNCC, which Dreyer said, again, was led by young people with lots of anger and determination but little political experience. At a D.C., Washington, D.C. meeting just recently, an activist named Eugene Currier put it this way. He said, right now we have tactics, but we don't have a strategy. We're doing a lot of important things, but ultimately, where is it going? We're ready to get arrested, and that's great, but are we ready to build institutions? End quote. Well, there's definitely a movement growing to reform the criminal justice system, whether it's against the shoot-first policies, like the one that allowed George Zimmerman to kill Trayvon Martin, or racial profiling and stop and frisk, drug sentencing reform, and felon disenfranchisement. But will the youth that are so important to most movements that led Occupy Wall Street accept discipline and coordination? Will the anarchist segment resist unification by the organizations that I know are out there behind the scenes? No doubt that segment will resist it. But the success of a mass movement isn't determined by the minority of professional activists. It's determined by the ordinary people, the Walmart workers, the black communities. A vast potential army of regular folks. Writer Danny McLean in The Nation calls it moving from playing defense to playing offense, addressing these problems at their roots. Well, another old guard member who's in his 70s today, named Ron Gregory, told a St. Louis crowd, well, the difference is in the 60s we were disciplined. Well, they had to be to create a picture that was black and white. Who was violent? Southern law enforcement and racist mobs. Who was nonviolent? The movement. Today, for better or worse, things are grayer. So are we at the dawn of a new civil rights movement? Well, like I said, the answer isn't black or white. It's gray, and it depends on a lot of things, including timing, whether this is the right moment. The anger unleashed in the recent protests suggests that it could be. The question is whether this anger is channeled and organized and given deep roots with a broad, unified vision and the institutions that can make it happen. If this happens, it will be worthy of the man that we honor today and tomorrow. May this indeed be so.